I have an idea here, just looking at your team, who, you know, based on the round and the value, who your best pick was. But who would you say that was, Fred?
Would it have to be AJ Pollock? I mean,
yeah.
I think he was the top fantasy producer this year, you know, depending on how you want to slice it. He's certainly in the top five. And
top five, without a doubt, yeah.
Yeah, and I took him in a double. I forget the exact round, but say round 13 or something like that. Yeah, I mean, I've actually been talking with some people recently about, is he a first-round pick next season? And I think he might be. I mean, if you can bank on roughly 20 homers, 40 steals, and 100 runs scored, and a .300 batting average, like, that to me, that's Carl Crawford-like in his prime. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe yep. Crawford had a little more speed and a little less power or a little less batting average, but it's pretty similar.
November and the waning sun, and all the proofs I like to prove, we go down tonight.
Good evening and welcome to episode 68 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me as always is Mike Ginella and George Bissell. Not only that, but we have a special guest coming later in this episode. We have Fred Zinke of MLB.com, better known as our main competition in labor mix this year. But we will talk to him in a little bit. But how are you guys doing tonight?
This is like the greatest podcast that we're gonna do, right? Like this is great.
This is it. This is it. This is why we do this.
I'm not saying it's like to brag, but we swept, and I'm saying it also in a morbid way, in that there's nowhere to go but down at this point, because the odds of this happening again, I mean, we can't top this, right? You know, I mean, it could happen again, but the odds of this happening again are not the best.
No, that's right. That's the point. And that's what you have to do in life, right? You can't top this, so you gotta enjoy it while you can.
But that's what this podcast is going to be. So I don't think we're gonna come across as gloating. I think we're gonna come across as happy, and it's gonna be a fun podcast. It's gonna beat the podcast from last year when, you know, however many days after Jose Fernandez last year went down and we were depressed.
Yeah, it'll be the opposite of that.
I was about to say that.
How are you, George?
I'm doing well. Hey, I was watching the scoreboard all weekend, the standings, and I was just thinking back to the conversation we had about whether or not this is going to be the happy podcast or the extremely sad and second most depressing podcast in Flags Fly Forever history. So I was very excited to see you guys pull it out. And, you know, you talk to someone, you know, like Fred and some other people in the leagues, and yeah, it just seemed like everything came together. You guys, not only did you have great drafts, but in season you managed to maintain the advantage you had coming out of the draft. So I think that's even more impressive, to not only come out of the draft with one of the best teams, but be able to keep that sort of lead and improve on that in season. So I tip my cap, and I'm very excited to, you know, be doing this with you guys, and looking forward to next year in March when we head down to New York.
Nice.
Are you saying you're coming to New York next year?
Oh, I would be there, Mike Gianella. You can bet on it. And you're going to barrage me with 80s references.
Awesome.
It's going to be fun.
That's excellent. So things will all end up in the Keaton's kitchen is what you're saying.
I have no idea what you're saying, but
of course you don't.
I agree with
George.
You. I'm on
Brett,
board with
know,
that.
Brett, you know that reference?
I do.
Of course you do.
Yeah. Here we are.
Yep.
So we're going
face to face, a couple of silver spoons. go ahead, Fred.
Oh, Ricky.
That's two.
So we're going to start. We're going to talk about NL Tout first, and then we are going to talk about mixed labor. The other stuff, you know, email us, flagsflyforeverbaseballprospectus.com. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. It's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And George is at George Bissell with two S's and two L's.
rate and review us stuff. Yeah, you know, it's all good. So NL Tout. Well, we'll frame this a little bit for those of you who haven't been framed. Most of you have been framed. This has been the league dominated by Tristan Cockcroft for the last three seasons, and his reign of terror is no more. So, Mike, how does that feel?
It feels good. Now, just to segue this, so I'm sure there are listeners to Flags Fly Forever who also listen to Fantasy Focus, and Tristan referenced me, and I hope you're listening, Tristan. I don't know if he listens every week, but or every other week, but Tristan's referenced me every day or practically every day on that podcast for the last 2 months as that guy. And there was also a segment on there that they had called, Hash Browns, which was actually a mistake by Eric Carabell, the other, host of the show who's in labor and, another good guy. He was supposed to say hashtag, said Hash Browns. So it became their segment where they played in with, five-time champion Tristan Cockcroft and, Eric Carabell. And Tristan and I kind of had a healthy rivalry. We wound up DMing a lot on Twitter. We wound up talking a lot about it. But, they had their in-jokes. We had our in-jokes. And I Brett knows this, and I don't think you know this, George. Every day, my rally song in Tout was Kill the King by Megadeth. I would play that song every morning as a rallying cry to beat Tristan, which I've told him before recording this so he wouldn't hear this and be surprised, and he thought it was funny. And he thought it was so funny, he was like, what? Like, you should have included that in your write-up. It's funny. And the other in-joke that we had was, my wife, Colleen, she said that, and actually Colleen and Tristan actually went to college together. They were a couple of years apart. It was like a friend of a friend thing. But she said, you should take him out, like kind of like a, Nancy Kerrigan, Tonya Harding thing. But she's like, if you do that, he'll just have more time to look at the stats. And, what good would that do you? So there were a lot of in-jokes on both sides. But to, get back to your question, I mean, it felt good. And this goes back to, we'll get to this with labor. It's great to win these leagues. But when you beat somebody like Tristan, who's so good at this and so consistently good, and I got into this new article, where he was in first place the 3 years he won, from July 27th until the end of the season or earlier. To beat somebody like that really feels good. It really feels like an accomplishment. It feels accomplishment when you win a league, but when you win a league like that with somebody who's at the top of his game, it really feels good.
It is it's definitely an accomplishment. So let's kind of start at the beginning. So we do, most people do remember from your draft about you grabbing the two biggest guys on your roster. You bought Paul Goldschmidt and Clayton Kershaw. Those were your two big buys. But we know those guys were really good. Who were some of the buys that you made at the draft that you thought really solidified the overall value on your team?
Well, somebody I'll mention, just off the top is Michael Taylor. So Michael Taylor, I got for four, and, I kind of looked at him as a backup, but I looked at him as somebody who I believed would, get enough time. You had Denard Span, who was coming off an injury, which I thought would be a little bit more serious than, people believed. Bryce Harper, I'm not a big believer in injury prone, but I thought, the way he plays, he plays hard-nosed, he'll miss some time, which he actually didn't. And Jason Wirth at his age, and with his injury history, I thought would miss some time. I thought Taylor would play enough, to earn like 10, 15 bucks. And, as it turned out, he earned a little bit more than that. And, the average or the on base in this league wasn't pretty, but he hit home runs, he stole bases, and he contributed. The other guy who was really big and, was kind of scaring me for a while was Carlos Gonzalez. He wasn't a value in that I paid 27 for him and the steals weren't there and the on base wasn't great. But he had, this is just crazy, and people won't remember this. He had four home runs on June 1st, and he just looked terrible. And he was a guy that I stood with, in part because he's an NL only, and what are you going to do? But I still believed he'd do something. I still believed he'd hit like 20 to 25 home runs or have 20 to 25 home runs by the end of the year. And as we know, he had 40. And he just went on one or two monster streaks where he just carried my team And it went from a team that was good on offense because of Goldie and because of a couple other guys to a team that was a dynamic team. And those two guys really put me in a position where, you know, there were some others. You know, I got Addison Russell on reserve, but those were the two guys I felt that just put me in a position where I had so much strength on offense that I could make some trades or make some moves for pitching that didn't really – I'd have to worry so much if they went wrong because I wasn't going to lose much on offense.
So let's talk about the pitching a little bit, because you did juggle around your pitching staff quite a bit behind Kershaw. And, you know, the idea behind Kershaw is that the rest of your guys don't have to be that good because he's that good. But how did your pitching staff end up working out the way you thought? Did it end up disappointing you? And how did it kind of progress over the course of the year?
Well, I was relatively disappointed in that, you know, Kershaw started out poorly. You know, we know a lot of that was because of the bullpen and his defense. You know, whether you looked at FIP or DRA or whatever metric you looked at, he pitched better than the numbers indicated. But in fantasy, that doesn't matter. But I had guys like Doug Fister and Andrew Cashner. Fister was just bad. Cashner was inconsistent. And the guy who saved my staff, and we've talked about this during the season, was Noah Syndergaard, who I paid two for, and, you know, I honestly was surprised I got him that cheaply. I thought I'd have to go to five or six, which was about what I would have went to. And basically, it just put me in a position where I thought that, you know, I would have to, like, trade for pitching and have to scramble. Syndergaard came up, I believe, in May. And suddenly, you know, he was just very good right off the bat. I think he struggled in one or two of his starts early, but I remember his debut against the Cubs. He threw a lot of pitches, and the whip was a little bit high. But he gave me a guy right behind Kershaw where I had to worry a little bit less. And then right around the time that happened, Kershaw just became Kershaw again. And all of a sudden, you know, I went from having like 4 or 5 points in ERA and whip to shooting up. I was never at the top of those categories, but I was good enough in those categories that – it was a weird team. I think I spent 169 on hitting and 91 on pitching, and I expected a pitching strong team with a hitting that was going to be okay. It was the complete opposite. The hitting was really strong, and the pitching was good, but it wasn't great, but it was enough to carry me.
So in season, and no, we've talked a little bit on the podcast about some of the trades that you made, but on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you grade your in-season trading in tout this year?
Probably a 7. You know, I think I made 3 trades. And the one trade that really worked out, and I think we were surprised about this, I got Jason Grilley for Hecheverry on the Marlins. And I think we were surprised because as much as Jason Grilley wasn't a top-tier closer, he was performing. We had him in labor, and it looked like he continued to perform. And until he, you know, ruptured his Achilles, he was fine. And in leagues like that, you often have to pay more for a closer. And I thought I'd have to give up more than Hecheverry, and I probably would have given up more as well. You know, I wouldn't have given up, you know, Paul Goldschmidt, obviously, but I probably would have given up a second-tier player or some a little bit below that. You know, Hecheverry was fine, but I just thought for a closer, he was somebody I could have – you know, definitely not surrendered quite as much for. The trade that really didn't work out on the other end of the spectrum was I traded Addison Russell and Jeremy Hellickson, who was just a free agent pickup for me, for Shelby Miller in the middle of his losing streak, which just continued forever. And when I got him, he just wasn't that good. I mean, he was great on the last day of the season, but overall, he was just kind of a disappointment. And, you know, Hellickson kind of fell off the map, so it didn't really matter. And as I mentioned before, my offense was really good, so it didn't really matter that much that I lost Russell. Like, it probably lost me, I think, the half point in runs I could have gotten, and it might have lost me a little bit elsewhere, but it just didn't make much of a difference. So, you know, overall, I think I could have probably traded a little bit better or been a little bit more aggressive. But, you know, as I've mentioned before on the podcast, expert league trading is hard. And there was another element of my strategy. You know, we mentioned Tristan Kakaroff before. Tristan was looking to trade a pitcher for a hitter, and I kind of really wanted to block him from doing that. And I kind of did. Like, I kind of played along with him like I was going to make a trade with him, and then I didn't. and it just made it a little bit harder for him to make a deal. Ultimately, he did, and it helped his team, but I think it was a little bit later than he wanted to do it.
All right, so same question, but for free agent acquisitions. Scale of 1 to 10, how, looking back on it, how happy were you with how you allocated your fab?
It was okay. You know, it's one of those hindsight things, and we talked about this. The big move for me, I hoarded a lot of my fab. And in part, I did that because I had some injuries. You can reclaim your fab for injured players and tout. So I reclaimed fab for Devin Mesoraco and Hyungjin Ryu. But the big guys for me in terms of the fab were, you know, stash guys like Aaron Nola, who I bid five or six on, but got for a buck because nobody else bid. Same thing with Stephen Piscotty. Same thing with David Wright, which I think you, Brett, were incredulous about at the time that nobody else bid on David Wright. The one guy I missed on was Kyle Schwarber, who I'm kind of kicking myself because my second catcher was garbage and had been garbage for most of the year, and I should have just, you know, stashed him like in June. But I did a really good job stashing players. And, it, you know, it's important to point out in tout, unlike labor, you can stash minor leaguers. And it was a big key to the victory, was just stashing these guys in the hopes they'd play, carrying a week of zeros and getting stats. You know, all three of those guys that I mentioned, or Nolan Piscotty in particular, just came up big for me. The other guy I got who was really helpful was Jorge De La Rosa, which if you're in a mixed league sounds absurd. And, you know, I know, Brett, you kind of talked about this and, you know, we've laughed about it. Whether it was luck or skill, the way I streamed Jorge De La Rosa and Jeremy Hellickson for about like 8 to 10 weeks was like magic. I always had the right guy in the right week. You almost knew. You would go look at the box and be like, oh, Jeremy Hellickson got bombed. Mike must have had him on reserve. if you want to do something funny, go look at what Jeremy Hellickson's stats were for my team and what they were for Steve Gardner's team in labor, and you can almost see like the difference between, you know, when the two of us streamed him. And I'm not claiming skill. It was just luck. The one thing that killed me with the free agent pickups, I had a choice between Jose Reyes and Yoenis Cespedes. I chose Reyes, which pretty much was wrong, as we know now, because Cespedes was ridiculous. But again, you know, I won home runs. I won runs batted in. It just really would have been a matter of how much of the margin of victory was. So it would have been nice to have Cespedes. He would have helped an on-base percentage. But it really, in terms of how the team finished, it really wouldn't have made much of a difference.
So is there anything else you want to talk about tout? I mean, we've been talking about it, and you know that kind of gives a good sense of how you built the team. But are there any big lessons that you are going to take into 2016 with you from this team being successful?
I think the biggest lesson that I'm probably going to take into next year is that as successful as the team was, or as successful as the auction was, the thing that I really improved with this year was churning. Well, there are two lessons, and I mentioned one of them in the column. The first lesson is in mixed leagues, and particularly shallow mixed leagues, people like to take guys like, maybe not so much Carlos Correa because he was expected to come up, but people like to take guys like Addison Russell or Syndergaard, who I mentioned before, or, you know, guys like that. And I mentioned success cases. People like to take guys like Javi Baez. You know, I'll mention the guys who failed, or, you know, I don't want to mention all Cubs. But, you know, they want to take people like that who are going to come up or think are make a big impact. And in an only league, I filled in with guys like Freddie Galvis, with Taylor, who I mentioned before, with Kelly Johnson, you know, with Yengirvis Solarte, who was great. You know, people laugh at these guys in a mixed league, but in an only league, they really pay off. You know, if you go back and look at Solarte's numbers and what he did for me and the fact they got him for $3, that's a big thing. So one of the things I'll take away is you can do stars and scrubs, or you can buy cheap guys and get production out of those guys. The second lesson, I mentioned this before, is that you really want to churn in a league like this. You don't want to give up. You want to keep plugging away. You want to take guys, you know, keep taking chances on guys like Nola, keep taking chances on guys like Piscotty. They might not all work out, but if you do that, you know, the other lesson here is read the stash list at Baseball Prospectus, because that was a huge part of that for me, was kind of studying that and really making sure that, you know, I was utilizing that to the maximum. So, you know, kind of take those low-end guys in a deep league auction who are boring players but are going to offer stats, and just keep churning and trying to stash guys, if you can, on your reserve list who might come up later and make an impact. Those are two biggest things for me.
George, do you have any questions or anything you want to touch on tout?
Yeah, the big thing I was just going to talk about was exactly what Mike hit on, was the value of getting some of those guys with regular playing time at the back end of the roster where they weren't significant investments dollar-wise, but just having those at-bats was such a huge advantage. I mean, if you look at some of the other rosters in the league, and in an only league, some guys are looking at part-time players that they have to start. It really becomes an issue. So I think, Mike, what you really did a good job of is when you have your two big studs like that, you were able to get those complementary pieces that sort of filled in around the margins. And you didn't need them to be stars. You just needed them to be, you know, complementary guys who could go in and give you 500 plate appearances. And that's exactly what they did. So the only thing I would ask you about is I made the joke on Twitter, but you know, back in the day they had the Jordan rules. You kind of have the Cockcroft rules. So what were some of the sort of things? I know you talked about it with trying to block him in trades and moves and things like that, but is there anything specific going forward that you would maybe do again that worked this year, you felt like?
You mean blocking him specifically?
Well, yeah, either that or the competition as well. Were there any things that you sort of implemented this year that you thought ended up being beneficial, not only against Tristan, but maybe some of the other league members as well?
The biggest thing to me, and I mentioned this, you know, both of me here at the end, is that Larry Schechter, he was also in tout. He wrote Winning Fantasy Baseball. For years, he talked about, you know, if you won the league in tout, you have the first call out. But he said, if I didn't win the league in tout, I would make sure to have the second call out. I did that, and it really made a difference sitting next to Tristan and having that control over Clayton Kershaw and pretty much knowing right away I'm either going to get Kershaw for 40 or less, you know, $40 or fewer, or I'm not going to get him and I'm going to, you know, have a completely different auction. And, you know, what's really funny about it is, you know, maybe if I didn't get Kershaw, I would have wound up with, say, Jake Arrieta and Jacob deGrom like we had in labor. But it just set me in a position where I was able to succeed. You know, the other thing which I mentioned before, and it's a strength of Tristan's, and I felt I blocked him with this, was stashing players, was being aggressive. Now, I didn't get everybody. You know, I mentioned he got Schwarber. He also got Will Myers, who I was kicking myself a little bit for. But Towers is a four-man reserve, so you can only kick yourself so much because, you know, really, you put yourself in a position where, you know, you can't stash everybody. You have to kind of make some decisions. So those are really the two big takeaways as far as competing against him and the league. Someone in the league, you know, years ago, Brian Walton, the Masters ball when he won, was also really good at stashing players. It's just a big thing in an NL only when you can stream guys who aren't up yet. You kind of have to do it. And if you don't do it, and I didn't do it the first couple of years or I didn't do it well, you just put yourself in such a big disadvantage or such a big hole.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about Tristan a bunch, but he did win three in a row coming into the year. And I think what you pointed out in the piece, maybe what's most impressive about that was the last 2 years, he came out of the auction without having the best team on paper. He was, what, third in both the last 2 years? Third and fourth.
It was third and fourth, I believe.
Yeah, so he's come from behind. You know, he's left the auction without the best team, and he's sort of that driving force that's always coming up on you. So,
well yeah. And unlike
really
Fred,
good.
Unlike Fred Zinke, and, you know, we'll get into this in the labor segment, he's a good trader, but he's not a master trader in the sense it's not trade after trade after trade. It's more strategic trading and then the free agent pickups and the combination. But yes, he's really good. And, you know, I'm sure next year that it's going to be this all over again where, you know, his run may have ended, but, you know, he is still the toughest or one of the toughest people to compete against in that room.
And unfortunately now the spotlight's going to be on you as well, my friend. So you better be ready.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Tout Wars. So if you saw the joke in the column, so I'll get my face on the money. I'll get an entree named after me. And yeah, there'll be all sorts of shenanigans at the. You can laugh at shenanigans, Brett, the way you laughed at Segway in the labor column. But there'll be all sorts of shenanigans at the auction, I'm sure.
There will be. So what? I guess that leaves the question now: is what's the entree going to be?
What does Tristan not like? That would be the big question. So he's had chicken parm on the menu for the last 3 years. I say screw that. We're gonna have something else.
What if you did like eggplant parm?
I've been actually thinking about that, but I don't know if he likes eggplant parm or if it's close enough.
yeah. So one final hearty congratulations, Mike, on a very well played season, and I look forward to spending some of the money with your face on it in New York in March.
It'll be a lot of fun. It definitely was a big win, and you know, like I said, it's. I mentioned this in the column. It's just kind of an honor to play in that league. I mean, so many people have come through there and you know done well. You know, Mike Lombardo, Tristan, Larry Schechter over in the AL. You know, Sam Walker, who wrote the Fantasyland book. You know, and this obviously doesn't take away from labor, but it's just such. It's just such a big league, and you know, as you know, Brett, from being in the last couple of years, it's such a big event. And I really, you know, to anyone listening to this, I'm definitely, you know, honored to, you know, be even in the league, let alone win it once.
Well said. So we are going to take a quick break, and then we are going to come back with our special guest. Back to Flags Fly Forever, episode 68. We are now joined by a very special guest. You likely know him already. If not, you should. This is Fred Zinke from MLB.com, who is joining us for this segment as we move from the NL only to the mixed conversation. So, Fred, welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I want to start by just asking one question before we get into some of the meat of what we'll talk about. You know, listeners of our podcast will know that you were our main competition. I ended up in labor mixed. In a race that was extraordinarily close, but what they might not know is that you won the tout version of pretty much the exact same league. So my question is, what similarities were there between your two teams? Not necessarily in players, although it could be in players, but in terms of the general strategy you set out with in the 15-team mixed format that made you so successful this year?
Well, to be honest, there weren't a lot of similarities between the two teams. My labor team, you know, that narrowly lost out to your club, was more of like what I would say is my stereotypical team, where I had an ace with Chris Sale, I had a lot of good closers, and then I tried to build a good offense. You know, throughout the season, I went really heavily after Carlos Correa on, you know, the waiver wire and bid heavily on him. And my Tout Wars team was almost the complete opposite, where I spent, I think, the last 4 to 4.5 months of the season with no closers, eventually built up a deep group of ace pitchers to offset that, and kind of won the league that way. I think I finished second last in saves in tout, and then finished second overall in saves in labor. So I think, yeah, really different teams, kind of similar results, but different makeups.
Yeah, you won. This is Mike. You won by 7 in, it looks like, in tout mixed. And you know, I think the other difference, just to remind our listeners, tout has two mixed leagues, and you were on the auction side. So, you know, I know from attending those auctions, and I always say this to people at those auctions, mixed auctions to me are crazy. Like AL and NL only auctions, there's some rhyme or reason. A lot of the pricing out there is pretty uniform. I still don't feel, and I even as a pricer, I still don't feel there's great mixed pricing out there. And a lot of it is just kind of feel or hunches, even for the experts in the room. Would you agree with that, or do you have a method in terms of how you price people?
I agree with you to a point. They can be all over the place. That being said, over the last few years with that tote auction, I find – and maybe some of the listeners can try this with their own leagues if they're doing mixed auctions. If when you get close to your auction, if you take your league and the amount of money that was paid for each hitter last season and each pitcher last season, starting from the most expensive hitter all the way down and starting from the most expensive pitcher and all the way down, and you just replace the names by using the ADP for this season. So you can get ADP from ESPN or from the NFBC or something like that, and use that in that ADP and just plug in the same dollar values, you can come up with a pretty good guess of what everybody's going to go for. So, you know, if like this year Trout, you know, you just replace with what someone spent the most on in the labor mix auction last year, and you have a pretty good idea of what Trout's going to be at. And if you take the 35th highest hitter on an ADP list heading into your auction, he's pretty much going to go for what the 35th most expensive hitter went in your same auction last year. Some leagues don't have the luxury of having that data, but we do in the expert leagues.
That's actually a really good tip. I often have used 3-year averages for mixed prices to try to do that. So, but even for 1 year, I would agree. I think that's a pretty good thing. I want to segue over to labor just because I know we only have you for a limited amount of time. And, you know, we could probably talk about tout all night and auction in particular. I wanted to ask about your draft just for a couple minutes. So we were on the other end of the wheel. We had the 15th pick. You had the number 2 pick overall. And, you know, I know this is a long way back to remember, but you started with Andrew McCutchen. You know, and Mike Trout was kind of the obvious number one. Was, you know, from what I remember, you know, you had Kutch, you had some people kind of looking at Paul Goldschmidt, you had a couple people maybe looking at Giancarlo Stanton. Was Kutch an obvious guy for you there, or was there somebody else that maybe you were considering? I know we're going all the way back to February, so, you know, maybe it's not the clearest at this point.
Yeah, I pretty quickly discarded Stanton, and I was kind of down to McCutchen and Goldschmidt, and also I was considering Kershaw, who went 3rd overall and would have been a better pick in the end. And what's funny about it, it just reminds me why fantasy baseball is so fun, is I picked McCutchen because I felt like he was the most stable option. We drafted in the first half of February, and by the time we got to opening day, I felt like he was the least stable option of all the players, you know, that I was really seriously considering. And I wound up trading him partway into this, you know, maybe about a month into the season. So it's just a good reminder that even when you think there's stability and safety in a player, there really never is.
That's really an excellent point. I definitely, you know, I've felt the same way, and particularly with these early, you know, auctions or drafts that we experts do. I'm in an NL only auction, and I took Zach Wheeler, I think, in like mid February and, you know, early February, and a week or two later, you know, he's out for the season, and you're kind of like, that really stinks. You know, something else you did that jumps out to me, you took 2 catchers. I don't want to say early, because other people did, but you took Jonathan Lucroy in the 5th round and Brian McCann in the 8th. We kind of went late on catchers. We took Derek Norris fairly late, and we took Wellington Castillo with our last pick. Do you typically take catchers on the earlier side, or was it just something that came up based on the draft and the opportunities there?
I almost always end up with – in 2 catcher leagues, I almost always end up with 2 pretty good catchers. I feel like it's I see the risk with catcher, and I should probably maybe a little more often maybe play with that second catcher spot a little bit, like you did with Castillo, where you take him late. He turned out really well. If he doesn't, it's kind of nothing really lost because you didn't invest much in him. But I feel like maybe there's a bit of a market inefficiency there, where there's a lot of owners in the drafts that I'm in who seem to want to avoid catchers in the first 10 or 12 rounds because the risks of the position, and, you know, they're not as big producers as players at other positions. I hate feeling like I'm playing a man down. You know, Castillo worked out really well for you guys, but if you end up with the Mike Zaninos, who also I'm sure went in that draft somewhere around 23 or something like that, and you end up with just kind of a hole in your lineup. I hate to have that. Now, in the end, I took Lucroy, who didn't turn out so hot. McCann turned out fine. But I'm usually willing, I find, to go with a couple catchers in the first 10 rounds.
Now, I have an idea here, just looking at your team, who, you know, based on the round and the value, who your best pick was. But who would you say that was, Fred?
It would have to be A.J. Pollock. I mean, I think he was the top fantasy producer this year. You know, depending on how you want to slice it, he's certainly in the top five. And
top five, without a doubt, yeah.
Yeah, and I took him in a double. I forget the exact round, but say round 13 or something like that. I've actually been talking with some people recently about, is he a first-round pick next season? And I think he might be. I mean, if you can bank on roughly 20 homers, 40 steals, and 100 runs scored, and a .300 batting average, like that, to me, that's Carl Crawford-like in his prime. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe Crawford had a little more speed and a little less power or a little less batting average, but it's pretty similar.
So I have two more questions before I turn it over to Brett. We kind of decided that I was going to do the draft questions and Brett was going to do the in-season questions. Another thing I see, you grab three closers or potential closers. You grab Koji Uhara. You actually traded before the season started. You grabbed Houston Street and you grab Sean Doolittle. And you grab them 9, 10, and 14. And I think this ties to a broader question, because Brett and I did this a little bit differently. Do you try in a draft or auction to go 10 categories across, or are there situations where you might, you know, if not dump a category, maybe push it aside or say, well, you know, I'm not going to worry about it as much?
Yeah, I feel like closers are drafting closers, I've always said, is kind of like doing your taxes. Like, nobody really wants to do them. No, you know, nobody really wants to draft a closer in the first half of their draft, but you just kind of have to sometimes do it and forget about, you know, the sexier picks at the time, and it pays off in the long run. So I'll usually just suck it up and make a point of getting two or three closers in the first half of my draft. For me, and Tout this year was really the opposite, where I got stubborn in the auction and didn't want to pay for the closers and went without them. But usually what I did in labor is kind of my MO, where I'll grab three closers in a 15-team league. I'll get three closers in the first 15 rounds. Hope to really, you know what I mean? Like,
yep.
I feel like I always like to target the hitters early, but then a lot of those hitters don't really turn out like you think. And I've always said there's two ways a closer can lose his job. He can either be injured or he can be ineffective. And hopefully if you take some of the better pitchers better relievers in baseball, you kind of rule out the ineffective aspect. I mean, Greg Holm was ineffective, but in general, with the Kenley Jansens, you cut your risk in half.
Yeah, there's something to that, particularly, you know, if you get a Chapman or someone who's a top shelf guy, and I say this all the time, it's not just the saves. You know, you had Betances at one point, who you got through trade. You know, he didn't close, but, you know, we had Betances last year in labor. It's under what relievers do in the non-save categories, particularly the elite relievers, is definitely underrated by a lot of players, without a doubt. My final question before I flip it to Brett, and, you know, I know this is kind of, again, you know, it's a loaded question because we're talking about months later. Did you have a feel about your team coming out of this draft? Like, did you feel that you had the best team? Did you feel you had a competitive team? Like, and, you know, you've done so well in these leagues that you must feel at the very least you're competitive every year. But did you have a good feel for this specific team coming out?
Yeah, I felt pretty good about it. I was really disappointed, to be honest, in how McCutchen started out the season. And then I don't think I made a panic trade with him, but I unloaded him pretty quick. I felt like if he was what I had hoped he'd be, that he would be a really good anchor. And then I came out with Felix, who wasn't awesome this year, but was pretty good. I ended up trading him too. But I felt pretty good about my team coming out. I feel like any owner who's well prepared should come out of a draft feeling pretty good about their team. I think you can come out of an auction feeling really shaky about your team, because as you said, the auctions are unpredictable, and once the bullets start flying, and, you know, next thing you know, it's a couple hours later and you think, oh gosh, what did I do with some of this money? But coming out of a draft where you can kind of sit back and, you know, have a few minutes in between each pick to collect yourself, I feel like you should come out of a draft feeling pretty good about your team.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's always a thing, and we kind of say that as experts, which is, you know, if you don't have, like, that good feeling about your team, you know, and you're an expert, you almost should quit, because, you know, honestly, you're using your projections, you're using your values, you know, and you really should feel good. So, Fred, I'm going to turn over to Brett, and he's going to ask you some questions about the in-season moves, and, you know, we'll kind of go from there. So, Brett, you have the floor for the next few minutes.
Sounds good. So, Fred, you already touched a little bit on what I assume your answer would be for your biggest free agent acquisition during the season, but I'll just pose the question to you anyway. What was the most important free agent pickup that you made during the season, and what were sort of the circumstances around that?
Yeah, for me in labor it was picking up Correa, and for me with him it was the perfect storm where he gave me exactly. Not only did I expect him to do very well, but I really needed a shortstop at the time. My middle infield was the weakest part of my team. So what I did when he came up is looked at how much fab I had left. I looked at how much fab most of the other teams in the league had left, and I bid basically as enough on him to rule out almost every team in the league. There were only a couple teams that could top my bid, and I saved just enough money that I had, you know, something along the lines of $10 left. So I felt like I could make about 10 $1 moves for the rest of the season. I was so high on Correa that I traded for him in Tout later on from Nando DeFino, and I basically said to Nando, pick anyone you want on my team, and I'll give him to you for Correa. So I was really high on him all the way.
So when you putting Correa aside, you sort of have the reputation in these leagues and of being a wheeler and dealer, at least especially compared to other experts, since these leagues can sort of be a little dry on the trading front. So, you know, outside of the big pickup of Correa, what were a couple of other moves that you thought were instrumental to you charging into contention this year?
Yeah, Mike actually touched on that. I drafted Koji Uehara and I traded him before opening day, and I traded him for Kenley Jansen and traded with Jeff Erickson. And Jansen was obviously hurt at the beginning of the season. And because I had drafted closer depth, I offered Jeff a healthy closer for an injured closer, kind of hoping – he was hoping he'd get 6 months out of Uehara, and I'm hoping I'd get maybe 4.5 out of Jansen. I ended up getting 36 saves out of Jansen, which is really good considering I didn't have to use him in my lineup for, you know, the first 7 or so weeks of the season. And then he ended up – I'm going to guess pitching roughly as many weeks as Uehara did anyways. So I felt like that was a pretty good one. I also traded McCutcheon and Steven Strasburg. I don't remember the exact deal, but basically I traded those two for Michael Brantley and Madison Bumgarner, kind of really when Strasburg was struggling in May. And, you know, even though Strasburg pitched really well in September, I got to skip that long stretch in the summer where he was either ineffective or injured. And Bumgarner's just so reliable. Brantley wasn't awesome, but overall he was pretty solid.
So, you know, we have talked on the podcast about how your team sort of crescendoed over the later part of the summer and into September. But what was the first point of the season when you started to make the charge that you really thought that the team that you had could win?
Yeah, to be honest, almost never. I never really felt like I knew the last week or so that my team had a chance to win. I never in my mind put my chance to win as more than like in that league as more than like 10 or 15%, even though I was getting really close to your team in the standings. Like, I didn't even look at the standings much until the last couple of weeks. I knew I climbed up. At first, I just wanted to climb up to the point where I felt like I would definitely finish second. And then I got to the point where it was close enough that I could win. All along, when I would look at the standings, it was one of those situations where I felt like I couldn't really win the league. Maybe your team could lose it. I felt like the only way I knew I couldn't get to the point total, you know, that you probably could, but I was hoping maybe your team would just really struggle the last couple weeks of the season, and you were at a Fab dollar. So I was like, oh, maybe a really bad run of luck for you, and your team would lose a few points and drop down. You know, you finished with 125. Maybe you drop down to 120 or something like that. But I never really felt – the way that league just ended up shaking out, I couldn't really move in any of the hitting categories. So there just wasn't a lot of room for movement for me late in the season, and I never felt like – in tout, I felt like I had a decent chance to win in September, and in labor, I didn't.
So do you have a general philosophy in season outside of obviously not being afraid to make, you know, to make deals and make significant deals? Do you, I mean, Correa was obviously a huge pickup for you. Do you tend to skew towards picking up younger players in with Fab, or was it just kind of taking the best guy available?
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. I really don't have any sort of set in-season strategy. One of the things I do like to often draft the closers or buy the closers at the auction so that I don't have to spend a ton of Fab on them, because they're usually pretty expensive during the season. But to be honest, and as you said, I make a lot of trades. In labor, I didn't make as many as I usually do. Like, I might have made maybe a half a dozen or eight trades or something like that in the league. In tout, I made 32. And I don't have like an end game or a general plan. Like, I really do fly by the seat of my pants, and sometimes I'll make a trade in like 30 seconds, or sometimes it'll be more thought out, but I'm pretty random where if something feels like the right move, I'll make it. And that goes for picking up free agents or for making trades. I like to interact with the other owners and just kind of exchange emails and get an idea where people are at and have conversations, get to know each other a little better. And then that tends to lead to me making a lot of moves, but there's really no end goal for me when I start making them.
Yeah, and I think that's good advice for every league. You know, I usually find that too, that, you know, conversation breeds trade conversation, which breeds trades. So, you know, it's sort of the natural progression of being, you know, natural progression of talking to the people in your league.
And can I jump in for just a second? I just want to say, and we've said this on the podcast, you know, I've been in Tout Wars now. This is my 6th year. This is my second year in mixed labor. In Tout NL, it probably took until year 3 to reach that comfort level. But it definitely came from what you're talking about, which is talking to other owners, getting to know them, getting to know their tendencies. You know, I think sometimes you think people are trying to screw you, particularly these expert leagues, but really it's just a matter of getting to know the person.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, often with other owners, I might, in these expert leagues, I might just throw out an email to someone on a Friday, just when I have a free moment, saying, hey, how's it going? How's life? And let me know what you're up to. And if you're looking to do anything with your team this weekend, you know, let me know, and I got an open mind, I'll consider it. And people who have played with me know that I mean that when I say I've got an open mind and everyone on my team's available and I'll consider anything. And then, you know, you just free flow from there. Some people might write back and say, you know, life's good, but I'm not looking to do anything right now. Or someone might write back and be like, oh, my pitching staff's really frustrating me. I really could use another starter. And then you just go from there, and sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't, but I appreciate the conversations, and then you can always double back down the road, and you just get to know people really well. And yeah, you're right that a lot of expert leagues can be kind of dry, but I think once you get the ball rolling, people start to realize that it's pretty fun to have a lot of these moves back and forth, and we don't need to become so attached to our rosters.
Yeah, I think that's definitely good advice. So last question for me. So be honest. I know you had a tight-ish race going on in Tout at the same time. But how much were you obsessing over the standings in this league while everything was really going blow for blow the last 2 or 3 days of the season?
Yeah, my race in Tout, like, I ended up winning by 7, but to be honest, the on-base percentage category was so tight that there was literally a 5-point swing available between myself and Scott Swainay, who finished in second. That because of that, and like OBP just is so wild and unpredictable day to day, that really captured my attention the last week. And like, I almost didn't even want to check the live scoring there, because you were moving up and down like 2 and 3 points in OBP like every 20 minutes. Whereas the labor standings were moving like slowly. We would each gain like 1 or 2 points or lose 1 or 2 points each day. And with labor, from my end of things, it was basically just my pitchers where I could move. So I didn't check standings as much. I'd more just kind of be keeping track on any given night. I'd be like, oh, you know, I really need this one pitcher to pitch well tonight. And other than that, I wasn't too worried about it.
All right. Mike, do you have any other questions before we let Fred go?
No, I just want to tell Fred, because I don't know if did you read our recap or no?
I did.
Okay, so I mean, I just want to kind of tip my hat to you because, and I think 10 of the 11 mixed leagues between Tout and Labor, your point total would have won. This to me was a great race, and you know, I kept telling Brett, you know, if we finished second to you, and if things went the other way, my head would have been held high because it was a great season for both of us. So, I'm sure Brett agrees with this. I just want to tip my cap to you. It was a great year. It was a great race. It could have definitely gone either way. And I mean, beating you, it really feels good because you're one of the best people. You're up there with Tristan Cockcroft and Larry Schechter. You're one of the best people I've ever played this game with. So, you know, hats off to a great year, regardless of the fact that you just fell short, you know, because of like two or three things on the last day not going your way, Fred.
Yeah, no, thank you. And, you know, and congratulations to you guys for winning. And I think you raise a really good point where people get wrapped up into whether they finish first or second or where they get to in a league. And that thought crossed my mind also on the final weekend of the season where, you know, people were saying to me, congratulations for winning Tout and, oh, too bad you didn't win Labor. And to be honest, my team in Labor accumulated a lot more points and was really overall more successful. I just ran into a juggernaut with your team, you know, and you guys had a great year and I couldn't get all the way there. But well, I think sometimes owners get wrapped up into like, did I finish first, second or third? But sometimes your final point total also really shows how successful you were.
Yeah. You know, on the other level to me, you know, I always point this out to people in home leagues who ask how hard the expert leagues are. You know, so in your home league, you might have that one guy who is really good and, you know, in my home league, there's like one other guy besides me who like is pretty good or like close to that level. You're playing with a bunch of people like that in expert leagues. And I think people sometimes don't realize that it's tough from day one and the whole season's tough and there aren't many holes. So to get to that level, like you're saying, you know, get over 120 points in a 15 team mixed league is really good regardless of whether you finish first or second.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. I thought I tried to sum up what I was thinking at the very end of that recap, and I think the line ended up coming out something like a competition worthy of two winners gets one because life is unfair, and that seems to pretty much sum it up. I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun competing with you on this, and regardless of which way it would have went, I think we both had a season to be very proud of.
For sure, and I already can't wait for next February to do it again.
Absolutely. Thank you again so much for coming to join us. We are officially claiming you as a friend of the podcast. We will hopefully have you on again soon, and thank you for coming on, Fred. Obviously you can find him at MLB.com, you should do that. So thanks again, Fred.
Yeah, anytime.
We'll both see you in March in New York at Tout Wars.
For sure.
Absolutely. Now it's back to the three of us. That was very very kind of Fred to give us his time like that. We enjoyed having him on, but we are not done talking about Labor Mix just because it's our team. It's our podcast's baby. It's what we've been bothering all of you listeners about over the last 7 months. So, George, I guess we're going to try doing this as a little bit of a Q&A, so that this doesn't end up being like a Mike and Brett back and forth version of the Chris Farley show. Hey,
I don't know what that is.
You remember that time that Curtis Granderson hit that home run?
That was great.
You really, George,
George, like, but that George, that was like the '90s. Like how
that was
far
like 1993, 94.
George, yeah, I don't even think I was born in 1991.
I know, but I would have been two. You know, Seinfeld ended when you were like eight, I think.
Yeah, but you can watch that on reruns. So
you can watch it.
When this is all over, you should find somewhere on the internet the episode of the Chris Farley show with Paul McCartney.
Does he know? Does George know who Paul McCartney is?
I know who Paul McCartney is.
He's getting all defensive now.
That's not exactly fair. Anyway, let's get out of this zone. We're in some weird twilight zone now.
We're gonna do a whole pop culture episode, George, and you're gonna be in hell. Trust me.
I don't think I'm gonna make it through that show. But all right, so I'm taking the keys right now. This is not good. Time out for both of you. I'm muting you. All right, the
Twitter dads. He's taking the keys and he's driving.
I had to do it. Okay. All right, so let's start off with the draft. First of all, congratulations to both Brett and Mike. Obviously, you represented Baseball Prospectus and yourselves in a most outstanding fashion. So congratulations, first of all. But let's think back a little bit to the draft. You know, coming out of it, your two big guns were supposed to be Troy Tulowitzki and Ian Desmond. You guys obviously had the end of the first round there where you had the back-to-back picks. So we've talked a little bit about how that was an advantage because you were able to, you know, get a couple of names ready and really double up with your picks. But were you surprised at how things worked out with Tulowitzki and Desmond? Because they didn't return, what, top 8-round value by the end of the year. Were you surprised at how that turned out? And I'll start with Mike.
Yeah, I would say I think – I don't know which one I was more surprised by. We were disappointed – I shouldn't speak for Brett, but I was disappointed by both of them. But the funny thing going back when I did the analysis, I was surprised the other way that they actually produced, you know, value in the top 120 or 130. And I think some of it is the way that the PFM, you know, through Pecota does this is it really values position. So that was part of our strategy was to take two shortstops. And I think when you look at the two of them, just on the whole, they're disappointing. When you look at them compared to some of the other shortstops, you know, Tulu's a guy who had 17 home runs with a decent, although not great, batting average. He didn't steal. You know, Desmond provided some of those steals. He provided that power. The average was terrible. So we were disappointed, but I don't think that they were complete zeros. And because of that, you know, it wasn't one of those situations that we took two guys in the top two rounds that returned absolutely nothing. And it kind of fit our team. You know, we had a lot of guys who produced at almost every position, particularly once we started getting into the free agent pickups, that we didn't have a lot of holes. So the fact that they were performed under their draft slot may have affected another team more, but I don't think it affected us quite as much.
Yeah. Brett, Charlie Blackmon, you guys took him in the sixth round. Do you have enough, you know, adjectives left to describe how good he is?
Not really. No, he. You know, I mentioned this in the write up. I think, you know, regardless of how good Jake Arrieta was this year, I think you can make a logical argument for Blackmon being our most valuable player on our team. I mean, he did exactly what we needed him to do and then trumped it. And you know, we had this conversation around the time of the draft and Mike was certainly a bit higher on Blackmon than I was, but I think you know, combined, I think we were a little bit more confident about Blackmon being able to repeat really what we talked about is him being able to repeat those last 4 months of last year, which was essentially, you know, 270, 280 average, maybe 15 homers, 25 steals. I think that was, I think, about what we were shooting for with that pick. And for him to run the way he did and rack up the runs the way he did, it was fantastic. I mean, there's no other way to put it. The way The way Fred talked about how AJ Pollock impacted his team, you know, that Charlie Blackman was that for us, even though the Pollock was slightly more valuable overall.
If you're listening to this, you can check out Brett and Mike's Expert League Recap, The Labor Mixed, on Baseball Prospectus, and that's where I'm kind of pulling this off right now. But one of the keys that you talked about for your draft, Mike, was don't reach past your comfort zone on starting pitchers. Can you kind of elaborate on what exactly that means for everybody and how that ended up impacting your draft in terms of you ended up with three pretty stellar pitchers in the 7th, 8th, and 9th rounds there with Garrett Cole, Jake Arrieta, and Jacob deGrom?
Well, there's a couple things here. So we've noticed, to go back to Labor 2014, which Brett said we never would do again, but I'm only doing it, you know, to frame the success.
I'll allow it for one episode.
Well, and, you know, we're talking about a good experience this year. So we've noticed the last few years, or the last 2 or 3 years in expert leagues, that people are really pushing or stretching for pitching. I think more than you're seeing non-experts do. And in 2014, we took Jose Fernandez. And, you know, he was a good pick at the time, and he was great until he got hurt, but then he got hurt. You know, once he got hurt, we were treading water. And what our philosophy essentially was, you know, coming into this year, is that unless a pitcher fell into our lap, we weren't going to stretch and take a pitcher, you know, particularly on the wheel, you know, at the, you know, end of the first round, beginning of the second round, end of the third round, beginning of the fourth round. And I think before we took Adam Wainwright in the 5th round, it didn't work out. We debated, I think it was Johnny Cueto, Brett, in the 3rd, 4th on the wheel, but he was taken 2 or 3 picks before us, so the debate just went away. But that's kind of what we were looking at. We didn't want to take a guy. A lot of people draft, I think, looking at positions. And, you know, Fred talked about this with closers. And, you know, I'm certainly not knocking Fred, who's great at this. That just isn't – this is something Brett and I both agree on. We don't have the philosophy of we have to take a guy here, we have to take a guy there, we need a pitcher. We felt like the pitching would come to us and our valuation or our rankings would come to us. And that's what happened. Now, you know, granted, there was some luck here, but that's what happened with Jake Arrieta, with Garrett Cole, and with Jacob deGrom. You know, these are three pitchers that we liked. Really, in the case of Cole and deGrom, what's kind of odd is we were right around where ADP was. And this goes back to what I'm talking about, where I think some of these experts had filled their pitchers and were like, okay, we don't need pitchers. We're going to wait now until the 10th, 11th, 12th round. So we were getting those guys a slot. You know, Arrieta was a guy who we were high on. I think we were about 10 or 15 slots above ADP. And obviously that worked out. You know, certainly based on where we took him, we didn't think he'd be the best pitcher in fantasy, which the PFM said he was. But it was just kind of a testament to where we had him valued and, you know, where he came out.
And Brett, these recaps are always fun because hindsight's 20/20. So what was something that maybe you left the draft feeling one way about that now that you look back at your team and the team you left the draft with that you feel completely different about today?
I think we mentioned it a little bit before, but it's really easy to forget that, you know, having Cole, Arrieta, and DeGrom, none of them were supposed to be our ace. And we took Adam Wainwright in the 5th round, and I, you know, looking back on that now, I certainly don't regret that pick at all. I think, you know, we talked about this when Wainwright got hurt, and that was sort of the part of this that was hard for me to swallow. I mean, we're all wrong about this stuff every once in a while. There was a lot of concern about Adam Wainwright at the time of this draft. People were concerned about his arm. People thought he was people dropped him well out of the top 10 among starting pitchers. I think he was like 14th or 15th pitcher taken in
that's about right.
Is somewhere around there. And I kept saying before the draft, I was like, Adam Wainwright is going to be okay. Adam Wainwright is going to be a top 10 pitcher. And, you know, I know, you know, just like I think you were a little bit higher on Blackman at that turn, I was a little higher on Wainwright. And when he came out and just was vintage Adam Wainwright the first, you know, month of the season, I felt great. And then the injury happened, and it was almost worse because it was worse because I felt like I was right and it still was wrong. Well, and it was I can't decide whether I would have rather had him just blow out his arm and it would have been just, oh, I told you so. Wainwright was, you know, he was broken. It was
right. But yeah. Well, to touch on George's point too about hindsight, just to tie into this, it's easy now to look back and, you know, if you look at our team and say, oh, you know, you had Arrieta, Cole, and DeGrom. You didn't even need Wainwright. But keep in mind, you know, Arrieta's streak started, you know, in the middle of the season. You know, for a while there, of those three, Arrieta was our maybe our second, you know, after the Wainwright injury, maybe even our third best pitcher. DeGrom had that awesome start. Cole was really good. You always expect guys who are doing well at the beginning to slip a little bit, and both Cole and DeGrom did. You know, if Arrieta had just gone out and did what he did in the first half, that would have been really good. But we may not have had the wiggle room that we had in ERA and WHIP. So, you know, when the Wainwright injury happened, we kind of looked at it like, well, these guys are performing. We should be fine. But there's always regression in pitching, so it made us a little bit nervous. So, you know, just kind of go back to the, you know, in hindsight, it's like, who cares? Adam Wainwright got hurt. But at the time, it stung a little bit, without a doubt.
You know, looking ahead at some of the in-season moves, your two biggest pickups came a couple months into the year on the offensive end when you went with Kyle Schwarber and Miguel Sano. Now, for those of you who don't know, we've talked about it a little bit throughout the season, but labor is a little different than tout. You can't pick up guys until after they've debuted. So do I have that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Just want to make sure.
You can draft guys like that. So if you want to draft Schwarber in February, you can. But that's it. You after that, you can't speculate.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure I didn't have it backwards. So it's a little different. You have to pick your spots when you're making an acquisition with Fab. So I'll start it with you, Mike. The two big moves with Sano and Schwarber, how did you decide that those were the two guys that you were going to go after? And how confident did you feel when you submitted those bids that you were going to actually end up with them?
Well, you know, Fred talked a little bit about Korea. We wanted Korea, but we knew, and, you know, Brett, you can refresh my memory on this if I'm wrong. We knew at the time that we wouldn't quite have enough fab to get him. So we made a bid, and it was a fairly aggressive bid, but we kind of figured that we were going to wind up, I think, second or third on him, which we did. So after that happened, we were kind of looking at guys to target, and Sano was the next guy. And I felt fairly confident we were going to get him, but there were one or two teams, I think Rasball was one of them, that have more money. And I believe Steve Gardner of USA Today, who at the time, this was like, I think right before the Giancarlo Stanton, or right after Giancarlo Stanton injury, you know, had a good amount of money as well. I was probably 80% confident we get Sano. I thought somebody else might be more aggressive, but I knew our bid was aggressive enough that if nobody came in that strong, they'd get him. You know, again, to go back to the hindsight thing, George, which is a great way to look at this, you know, he did really well. I believe he had 17 home runs, but, you know, with a rookie, and that was the year of the rookies, there's never a guarantee that someone's going to come out of the blocks like that. Schwarber was a surprise. And we got him for six, which was the last of our fab. And part of the reason we bid that way is we thought, well, you know, it's Kyle Schwarber. He's a catcher. It's a two-catcher, 15-team league. This is almost a vanity bid. Somebody's going to bid like 10 to 12 conservatively, and we're not going to get this guy. I was, and I'm sure, I know you agree, Brett, I was shocked to get him.
Yeah, so was I. And I think, you know, the thing that made Sano and Schwarber be the keys to the team that they were is that, you know, it was the first week of July. We had $32 in fab left, and we bought two players the rest of the season. And that is abnormal for a team that was in first place.
Yeah. And labor doesn't have a $0 fab like tout does. So we knew with Schwarber that the risk was we're going down to zero, but again, I just didn't think we were going to get him.
Yeah. And, you know, it speaks to the confidence that we had in those bids. I think we were both, you know, obviously we both really wanted Correa. I think if I remember correctly, we bid 36 on him and we had $41 or $42 a fab at that point.
It was 42.
So we had no chance of getting him, for even if we bid every single dollar we had, Fred still would have gotten him. But, you know, when we bid on Snow, when we saw him there, we both said, okay, what do we need to do to get him? And that was where we came up with that number. And then with Schwarber, we were just like, oh, fuck. Sure. I mean, for $6 of fab for Kyle Schwarber, and, you know, it is no secret how much I adore Kyle Schwarber.
Well, we had one of the weeks, with good reason. Well, yes. it was one of the weeks that you couldn't host, Brett. We had Steve Gardner on as a guest, and I don't know if you remember this, George. He was pissed. Like, yeah. he just had that sound, and this was, again, when he was still, like, kind of in the race. He just, you could tell, like, you know, he was polite about it because it's Steve, he's really nice. But you could tell me that politeness, he was mad that the league let us get him at that price.
Yeah, I think it was a weird situation because didn't he come up for like that one series to DH and then he got sent back down? So he was available and you guys ended up
What happened was we bid on him after that. We bid on him when he came up.
Yep.
But the thing was that it was the All-Star break week. You know, right. Steve mentioned this on the podcast. He's like, sometimes in that week, you know, it's a short week. People aren't quite paying attention as much as they should. They're not looking at things. You know, and again, in a non-carryover, even an expert non-carryover, people out of the race really aren't, you know, paying as much attention, you know, as they should be. And we're seeing this more with some of these joint, you know, I don't want to go into the whole tangent on this, but we're seeing this more with these joint, you know, fantasy baseball and football experts, where I think on July 15th, they're already looking at football.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's applicable to all leagues. If you're just playing in a home league listening to this, if you understand prospects and you understand who's performing in the minor leagues, when these guys get called up, like Mike talked about, what Fred talked about, the importance of stashing players, so to speak, and that's one of the big things we do with the stash list at BP is you need to know about these guys and know what their value is going to be. Like you said, when you made the Sano pickup, I mean, all you really expected is power, and he gave you so much more than that, but I think just having that basic understanding is really an advantage. But Brett, I want to ask you about which pickup surprised you the most in terms of you didn't expect much when you made it. You only made 16 moves the entire year. But which guy kind of surprised you the most that you weren't expecting a whole lot from, other than Joe Kelly, I guess?
The guy who definitely fits that for me is Aaron Hicks. We picked him up for a dollar. He was, I think, our third contingent bid the week that we picked him up. I think that was the week that we tried to get Ben Paulson and the week that we tried to get Justin Bour. And he was third or fourth on that list. And he came to us for a buck and we were like, okay, fine. You know, he's someone to throw in there. And like I said in the write-up, I mean, he was never our best player or one of our best players, but damn if we needed him when those outfielders got hurt, and he gave us exactly what we needed to stay afloat. He's definitely the guy for me, but mostly because I think we were both really, really confident in AJ Ramos when we picked him up. We paid $2 for Ramos like a week or two before he became the closer, and I was honestly shocked that we got him. And I think we were the only team that even bid on him because we were talking about throwing a dollar bid and then we bumped it up to $2 because we both wanted to make sure we got him. So I don't think that was much of a surprise. I definitely think it's Hicks there. Mike, what do you think?
You could make an argument for Carson Smith, but yeah, I think it's Hicks. And, you know, we talked about Jordan Schaefer earlier. Hicks did what I think we were hoping Schaefer would do with some power to throw in. You know, he stole some bases, he had a couple home runs. And, you know, the funny thing about Hicks is when he faded, by that time the injuries were, you know, like gone for us or off the screen, and we just could kind of shuttle him onto reserve. And then we could move him back again later in September when we were out of the fab and had the injuries, which is great too. You know, that we had that depth, you know, after a round of fab, and you know, with the exception of like a couple of, you know, ugly Jared Weaver starts, we weren't really impacted that much by running out of Fab. But yeah, it was definitely Hicks. He was the guy for me as well who, you know, just augmented our team perfectly when we needed it.
All right, I'm going to wrap up this Q&A, which has been a lengthy one, but a good one, with one final question. I'll start with you, Mike. Fantasy baseball, it's kind of a process. You get better, you learn every year as you play. What was something this year that you felt like you took away that will improve your process sort of going forward into next year? As sort of a final thought, what was something that you're taking away from this season? Obviously very successful, but from either a positive or a negative standpoint, what's something that you learned this year that's going to help going forward?
Well, I think in labor, and you know, Brett maybe can speak to this too, and I've spoken to this before. I think the first year we partnered in labor, you know, we certainly get along and, you know, we work well together, baseball prospectus, but because Brett's a dynasty guy and I'm more of a traditional roto guy, I think our philosophies didn't exactly mesh in year one, and we kind of were like courteous to each other to fault. So like Brett may have wanted to take closer a little bit too early last year, which didn't work. And you know, I kind of really didn't want to speculate on like young guys. This year we did much better kind of working with each other. We took closers later, and when they didn't work out, we just kind of shrugged and said, well, you know, the rest of our team is strong enough and we'll get closers, you know, which we did. We mentioned Ramos. We mentioned Carson Smith. You know, he wasn't a great buy in terms of the dollars, but, you know, we made the aggressive bid early on Jason Grilly, which, you know, kind of kept us in the category at the beginning. But really, you know, in terms of the learning experience, you know, is taking guys like Noah Syndergaard and taking guys like Anthony DeSclafani, who in a 15-team mix had value, and, you know, taking these spec plays late that in the past I just might have shrugged at and said, well, let's just take the boring veteran. The boring veteran, even in a 15-team mixed league, you just don't need that guy. He's going to be out there later. You know, if you want James Loney or whatever the next equivalent of the good James Loney is, he'll be out in the free agent pool. You get him for a buck or two. Taking these spec plays, you know, like Syndergaard, like Andrew Heaney, like, you know, Anthony DeSclafani, they might not all work out, but the upside is much higher, you know, on those guys than it is on the boring veteran. And that's kind of what I took away from this, which is take the risks. Like, you know, one of the risks that Brett wanted to take, which didn't work out, was Jurickson Profar. But in terms of what we did in the last six or seven rounds, that really cemented our team. It really put our team in a position where, you know, we were able to, you know, not just be competitive, but really put this team over the top.
Somehow it always comes back to Anthony DeSclafani. Brett?
It always does. Yeah, I thought, you know, to echo what Mike said, I thought, you know, we learned a lot about being a team in 2014. And I think we brought that into 2015, and not to say that, you know, I think we were sort of the other way. I think in 2000 we've never been the type of partners to really argue about a move either way. I think there's a, you know, a ton of mutual respect in both directions. So if, you know, Mike, if Mike says, you know, there's a guy on the waiver where I want to put a $2 bid on, I'll go, yep, okay, that sounds good to me, unless I really think it's a bad idea, and you know, those situations really rarely ever come up, but I think I felt more confidence in 2015 in sort of pushing guys that I felt a little more strongly about, and I think Mike did the same thing, and I think when we both did that, I think it gave us a really good baseline of knowledge. The other part of that is that, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. I mean, I know I have the reputation of being a dynasty guy, but I've been playing in roto leagues for 20 years, and it is a comfortability thing. I mean, anytime you're in a new league in the first year, you're feeling things out. You're not entirely sure how it's going to go or what you need. But by the second year, you know, when you've been playing this game long enough, by the halfway through the first year you're in a league, you know and you know what you need to do. And I think we learned, and you know, we'll take those lessons into 2016 as well.
Absolutely. So congratulations again, you guys. It was a fantastic season, and hopefully we're doing this again next year. So we'll see. I'm going to hand the metaphorical keys back to Brett.
Cool. Congrats, Mike.
It was really a great year and terrific, and I don't know how many more effusive adjectives I can throw out there. So I think... Let me ask you, Brett, before you do the closeout or whatever you're going to do, like, did you have a moment? I know Labor was a little bit crazier because it was like the last second, and, you know, it wasn't until the last hour that we, you know, knew we were going to win, if not less than that. Did you have a moment, like, before it was over where, like, it went from not sinking in to sinking in?
Yes, I think it did happen very, very suddenly. But when Volquez had gotten those strikeouts, once I opened my at bat app and I saw that Chris Hatcher came out for the ninth inning of that Dodgers game, then I knew. I mean,
to explain to our listeners, you know, and Fred mentions Jansen was one of his closers, and you know, a save point was possibly at play, or I'm sorry, it was strikeouts.
Yeah, Volquez got the strikeouts. He was two strikeouts away from tying the team ahead of him, and three strikeouts away from taking a full point back, which at that point would have tied things back up with us. And he was the only pitcher who was left in any game at that point, and he didn't come in the game. And then that was when it sunk in.
I just bring this up because, you know, as someone I've won the CBS expert leagues like three times, and I don't say this to. You know, and I know, Brett, you've been in other expert leagues too. I don't say some malign other expert leagues. There's some good people in those leagues. There's some crossover. But, like, tout, there's always the point in a league, whether it's expert league or not, where you know you're going to win, but you don't want to say anything. You know, things can go badly, or there can be an injury, or something crazy can happen. And some of it's just a courtesy to other people in the league. But for tout, you know, we talked about this, like, offline, Brett. There was probably a week and a half to 2 weeks where I knew. But you don't want to go public with that. You don't want to be that guy. You don't want to, like, start, you know, doing your victory lap before the season. You don't want to curse the baseball gods. But the day the season ended, like a few hours before, when I had that feeling, when I knew, it was really an overwhelming feeling. Like, it really was the feeling of, oh, my God, like, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to win this very special league that these special people before me have won. And it really... It's just something that's very hard to describe, and I'm sure all the winners of these leagues have felt this way, and I'm sure you feel this way about Labor, Brett, but I just feel overwhelmed still, like, at this point, a few days later, that it happened. It's almost a dream in a weird way, and I, you know, all this sounds like corny and ridiculous, but that's how I feel.
It's an accomplishment. I mean, this is what we do. We are fantasy baseball analysts. This is the pinnacle of what we do.
Yeah, and there's really good analysts who are out there who, you know, have not won these leagues. And it's not a knock on them. It's just the combination of luck and skill that you need. And, you know, as much as people talk about luck, you do have to have the skill. And I mean, that's some of it. Like, I just feel that I could finish second or third in these leagues forever, but there's something about winning them that just is kind of a vindication of everything that we do.
I agree. I'm with you. So I think that's going to close out our show. I mean, I know we've gone on for a while. I know we talked about the sweep at the beginning of the episode. I think we realized that the tout league that I was in ended 2 weeks ago. I don't think we talked about it on the podcast, but I did pull out the victory, the three point victory over the hard charging Pat Mayo Roto experts in Tout X. So that was that felt good as well. It was kind of nice
So you might say it was Brett and X hold the Mayo.
Pretty much.
That is totally the intro.
Of course it is.
So, are they doing that again with the monthly format going forward at all, Brett? Because I know Chandler Park kind of isn't. Yeah.
No, the point of Tout X is for the format to change.
Oh, okay.
So it's to kind of choose a. And my understanding is that Ron and Peter and Laura are going to and Jeff are going to sort of rotate years, and they're each going to pick some sort of experimental format and that the league members are going to compete in. So I have no idea what the format of that league will be next year. All I know is that it will not be the monthly league again. So that is it. I will be honest. I am glad that league ended 2 weeks before the end of the season, so I was able to focus my obsession squarely on labor, which was nice and unhealthy, but nice.
Before we leave, actually, did you guys win any? You know, George, we haven't talked about your leagues. Did you win any leagues this year, George?
Oh boy. We went into the darkness, so to speak, in my long-term dynasty league. It did not go well at all, which is unfortunate. I think I learned a lot. I finished third the year before. I don't play in very many leagues right now. I'm looking to get into more for next year, but this is the league I pay the most attention to. I do a couple of expert leagues, but I feel like I got bit by injuries a bit more, and it kind of feels like last year you guys had with labor, where you felt like your process overall was pretty solid, that there wasn't much that you would change. It just felt like things didn't break right and you had a bunch of injuries. So I feel like I lost a lot of key contributors down the road that I was counting on. You know, guys like Corey Dickerson just kind of never got going, and that's what killed me. So I'm very excited for 2016. I'm already looking forward to it. So it's going to be exciting.
Did you win anywhere else? I mean, not that, you know, winning labor and X is you know, chopped liver, but did you win anywhere else, Brett? Or
I did not win any other leagues, although my portfolio was pretty strong overall. I have a very very strong home league that I've been playing in for a long time. I finished third in that this year. I finished the longest running dynasty league that I'm in. I lost a heartbreaking finals matchup by it's a points league. I lost by 20 points, which. Well, I guess it seems like a lot until you realize that I scored 1,780 points.
Points leagues are funny that way.
Yeah. I made the playoffs in every other league I was in, and other than one keeper league that I dumped in June, I think I was pretty respectable in pretty much everything. I ended up finishing third in TDGX, which...
Oh, that's good.
We'll probably talk about it on Tino podcast, but we kind of talked about it a little bit last week, even though the season wasn't over. But yeah, it was a pretty strong showing overall. I thought I was happy with this season.
I just wanted to ask, because you know, really, I know if you listen to Tristan and Eric's podcast at ESPN, I still enjoy stories of other leagues, and particularly the crazy last day or last game things that come down. I never get tired of those stories from other leagues. I know that makes the exception. Some people don't want to hear about it. Leagues they're not in, but I enjoy those stories.
I just looked it up. Some of my other, I mentioned Corey Dickerson, but my two best pitchers were Yu Darvish and Marcus Stroman. So it was a rough season on the pitching. I think I lost like pitching. It was a head-to-head league, so I was consistently getting crushed in pitching. And you just in a dynasty, it's hard to get out of that kind of a hole. So yeah, it was a sad year, but 2016 it's gonna be better.
And you're coming to Tout Wars in March, which makes me really happy. You'll be the youngest person there by I think like a, no, that's not true. But
I'm very excited.
You'll be the youngest person there by a decade.
There'll be a lot of references I don't understand there, but at some point the people will start to become my age, and we'll have references you guys don't understand.
So you're I thought you were implying we were going to die.
No, 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 the next generation, Mike.
This took a turn.
This is too dark for the celebratory podcast. So we're gonna cap it.
Yeah. Cool. Sorry, Brett.
So yes, this was fun. Let's do this again next year.
Yes.
For myself and Mike and George, thank you for listening to us during this season. We are not going anywhere. We are going to continue to record this throughout the off season and talk about valuations and strategy, all the stuff that hopefully you enjoy hearing us talk about during the season. In the meantime, you can continue to read us on baseballperspectives.com, find us on Twitter. That's it. Have a wonderful evening. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Happy 2015, everyone.
Good night.
Fred.
It's Mike.
And Brett.
And I'm George.
Yeah. Yep. I was gonna say, if you could do that with a little more tone, you could be the start of a barbershop quartet.
Hello.
Maybe the very start of a barbershop quartet. Yeah. Definitely not the other part of a barbershop quartet.
Hey, they all got their start somewhere.
Fred just wants to make us sing.